This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
United Nations aid agencies warn they have a two-month window of opportunity in drought-stricken Somalia in which to increase emergency assistance for millions of people and avert a catastrophe.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details next. Also, in Nigeria, the northeastern city of Maiduguri was attacked by as many as seven suicide bombers today. And protesters in South Africa marched today demanding restitution for a major bank for its apartheid-era profits. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, United Nations aid agencies warn they have a two-month window of opportunity in drought-stricken Somalia in which to increase emergency assistance for millions of people and avert a catastrophe. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations estimates half of Somalia's population, or 6.2 million people, are threatened by the drought which is spreading from the hard-hit northern regions. Over the past week, representatives of the World Food Programme and the UN Children's Fund visited some of the worst affected areas in the northern Puntland region. They describe scenes of utter devastation where people have reached the limit of their abilities to cope. WFP Country Director Laurent Bouquera says in one village, about 500 women and children were living precariously in makeshift huts surrounded by dead livestock. He says the men had left the village in search of grazing land and water for the cattle that were still alive. Speaking on a telephone line from Nairobi, Bouquera told VOA, "There is a short window of opportunity in which aid agencies can increase emergency operations and prevent the worst from happening."
The severity, the spread of the drought and of the situation this time around is bigger, is larger geographically than what happened in 2010-11. Therefore, if we don't respond fast enough, if we don't respond at scale, yes, we can prepare ourselves for a catastrophe which is at least to the size and the intensity of the situation we experienced over there in 2010-11.
Nearly 260,000 people, half of them children under five, died during the famine in Somalia between 2010 and 2012. UNICEF projects the number of severely malnourished children in Somalia could reach 270,000 over the coming months. Although the situation is extremely grave, WFP's Bouquera says Somalia has a better chance of averting a catastrophe this time around. He says the international community has been alerted to the crisis for some time and has begun responding earlier to this emergency than to the last. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Protesters in South Africa marched today demanding restitution from a major bank for its apartheid-era profits. It's part of a growing movement to address deep racial imbalances. The movement calls for land to be forcibly redistributed to disfranchised black South Africans. President Jacob Zuma has indicated through proposed legislation he may be prepared to do just that.
A small protest for a movement that has captured the attention of South Africa's most powerful players. Some 200 activists from the far-left Black First, Land First movement gathered wearing Land or Death t-shirts and sang protest songs seeking restitution for apartheid-era profits from a major South African bank. But as their name indicates, this pressure group has its sights set on something far bigger. They want land to be given to Black South Africans as compensation for colonial-era land seizures. And they're not the only ones seeking to rebalance the scale. Also on Friday, President Jacob Zuma referred a bill back to Parliament that seeks to redress racial imbalances in land ownership. Lindsay Masdorp, national spokesman for Black First, Land First, says the government's efforts are insufficient. His group objects to the current policy that allows landowners to hold out until the selling price is acceptable. He says Zuma's constitutionally based approach is also not enough.
We're saying black people should be buying back stolen land. We agree that we should not. White people didn't come here and just start speaking to us and say, hey, yeah, let me take it. It was a violent process and it continues to be a violent process. When we confront violence, we will do so with violence too. Sometimes it will be with words, sometimes it will be through dialogue, but other times it will be physical as well.
In recent years, anger over land inequality has been accompanied by violence against owners of farms and small holdings. South African police typically report about 500 incidents each year. Unemployed 45-year-old protester Simon Kufelo says his lack of land affects him deeply.
When talking about the debate of land, I become too emotional because at this present, we shouldn't have been talking about this. I mean, we have made about 23 years in democracy, and then there's nothing that is happening with the land distribution. 80% is still whites having 80% of land, and we, the majority, we are having 20%. I think if they can make sure that they are no more going on the snail pace, but try to pick up and move faster like a Ferrari, I think.
That 80% statistic has been thoroughly debunked by government land surveys. A recent private survey looking at residential property says black South Africans own 52% of the value of the nation's homes, and that figure is rising. However, nearly 80% of South Africa's population is black, meaning they are still underrepresented in this domain. This imbalance clearly preoccupies President Jacob Zuma, who spent about 15 minutes of his recent 90-minute address to the nation talking about radical economic transformation, a plan to use government programs and resources to encourage more economic participation by black South Africans.
The skewed nature of ownership and leadership patterns needs to be corrected. There can be no sustainability in any economy if the majority is excluded in this manner.
But, says Associate Professor of Economics Christopher Malikane of the University of the Witwatersrand, Zuma's ambitious plans may be just political maneuvering. Analysts say Zuma's growing unpopularity led the long-ruling African National Congress to lose ground in last year's local elections. As a result, the party is now divided and scrambling to gain support ahead of crucial national elections in 2019. This radical economic transformation, Malikane says, may be a casualty of the current rift in the ruling party.
It is the struggle between these two factions, basically within the ANC, that is going to lead the ANC not to coherently implement what the president is talking about, because his faction itself is not 100% in control of the ANC.
But many protesters on Friday said they have little interest in watching this complex debate go through the political and legislative motions. They want land, they say, and they want it now. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria.
In Nigeria, as many as 7 suicide bombers, 6 of them women, tried to attack the northeastern city of Maiduguri today. AFP quotes the National Emergency Management Agency, NEMA, as saying there were no civilian casualties, only the would-be bombers died. Some were killed when they blew themselves up, while others were shot by local defense forces. More violence early this morning at the Spanish enclave of Ceuta on the Moroccan border. Sub-Saharan African migrants again stormed the fences with tools and bats. Many broke through, but injuries are reported among migrants and police. There are frequent break-in attempts because migrants view the territory as a gateway into Europe. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following developments on Ceuta and other migrant-related news. From Rome, she spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Hundreds of migrants smashed their way into Spain's North African territory of Ceuta from Morocco early on Friday. They clashed with some police. The numbers could be around 300 to 500 people. There's also video available on the web where we see the migrants actually jubilant for having made it through, yelling out, Viva la España, long live Spain, and big smiles and lots of excitement. But they did clash. There were 3 police from the Civil Guard of Spain and 2 migrants injured and taken to hospital. and around 30 migrants were being treated for broken bones, according to some media reports. And on the other side of the frontier, there were 10 Moroccan armed forces also injured as there was this surge of migrants from North Africa into the Spanish territory.
Now, obviously, the migrants are happy to be there, but is there any guarantee that they will be allowed to stay and then move on to Spain and other parts of Europe?
It seems that they have been cordoned off to some degree, and it's not clear whether they're actually all in the same area or some have actually escaped already. But you may recall the last attempt that took place on New Year's Day when more than 1,000 migrants tried to jump this double fence that separates Morocco and Ceuta, and one officer at that time lost an eye. So they're desperate to get into Spain as they are into Italy and other parts of Europe, and there's no sign of this slowing down in the future.
I'm sure we'll be talking about Ceuta again, but let me ask you about a possible deal between Italy and Tunisia regarding rescued migrants. Would you tell us about that?
We had a report in one of the Italian daily newspapers today saying that Italy is close to reaching an agreement with Tunisia on accepting migrants who have left from Libya and picked up in international waters by Italian and European rescue teams. Under this arrangement, the Tunisian government would obtain financial support and other support from Italy and the EU in exchange for accepting refugees that have been rescued. Now, the Italians wanted to propose 1,000 migrants per month, but Tunisia only wants to accept 200 a month. In exchange for that, Italy and the EU want to give the Tunisian government financial support, step up their security, and perhaps share greater intelligence regarding terrorism and other issues. This is also being talked about as a model for other countries across North Africa.
Now, Pope Francis is also speaking out on the migrant crisis today. What does he have to say about the ongoing influx?
Well, Pope Francis, as we know, feels very strongly about social justice. He's spoken out many times in support of migrants and refugees. Today, he made some very strong comments, once again noting that the Mediterranean Sea is a cemetery, what he calls a cemetery. And he also accused developed countries of being very much to blame for the war, the famine, the poverty, the joblessness that forces so many people to leave their home countries and make that journey to Europe in search of a better life. His challenge is for many of us to embrace difference and diversity and celebrate that, to support our neighbours, to welcome our neighbours, no matter where they come from.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna from Rome. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. 18 past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. 6 years ago, the Arab Spring arrived in Libya and began with peaceful demonstrations in Benghazi. But then, leader Muammar Gaddafi responded with lethal force, triggering a war that led to his downfall after 42 years in power. Much political turmoil has ensued, with rival individuals and governing bodies, including the UN-backed Government of National Accord, or GNA. This week, Egypt's Chief of State, Lieutenant General Mahmoud Hagazi, mediated between the head of the GNA, Faiz Sarraj, and Caliph Haftar, the country's powerful army commander. They agreed to form a committee to renegotiate a UN peace deal. Former Egyptian ambassador to Libya, Hani Khalaf, spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi about whether any changes should be made to make the deal work.
The additions that could be thought of or changes, ameliorations that could be done in Sukhairat deal would relate directly to the relationship between the Libyan armed forces headed by Khalifa Haftar and its relations with the parliament or with the national consolidation government headed by Faiz Sarraj. This problem seems to be ironic because Faiz Sarraj people would care very much to have the commandment of the armed forces in Libya under their control, while the widely recognized parliament of Tobruk insists on having this commandment under his own control. Khalifa Haftar tends to believe that he is easier to work with the parliament and not with the government of Tripoli. This is the problem, and we have to face it. Maybe some work should be done closely with the various rivals in Libya to solve this problem.
How about the so-called salvation government in Tripoli?
No, this is not recognized there anymore. This has been replaced by the National Conciliation Government headed by Faiz al-Sarraj and endorsed in the Sukhairat deal. The other problem facing the whole Libyan parties lie within the fact that even the parties in the western part of Libya are still conflicting with each other. The people of Misrata, some organizations in Zawiya city and in Tarhuna, are still challenging the authority of the conciliation government of Faiz al-Sarraj. Though they seem to be taking one side against Khalifa Haftar and the people in the east, but from within, they have some differences and different approaches.
So, if one of the changes was to include General Haftar as the army commander, what would that mean for Haftar's ambition?
The problem is whether he is ready to receive political guidance from the parliament or from the head of the government. Normally, any other state, any military body should follow the political guidance given by the chief of the state, who is now Faiz al-Sarraj.
According to the agreement, once the parliament based in eastern Libya endorses the changes, it would pave the way for parliamentary and presidential elections next year. Would that work?
Yes, if both parties execute sincerely and exactly what has been agreed upon in Cairo, I think the other step would be to wait for the parliamentary elections and presidential elections and the additions to the constitution, the changes that should be made into the constitution declaration. So we are hoping that all parties would stick to what has been reached in Cairo.
Would the Egyptian mediation replace the UN role in Libya?
I don't think so. The Egyptian role is helping the UN to bridge gaps between the very many rivals in Libya. It should not be called exclusive Egyptian mediation because some of its movements and segments are shared by other neighboring countries to Libya, namely Tunisia and Algeria. I think we share with them some concerns, particularly that related to fighting terrorism and terrorist movements. And secondly, the securing of the borders. But when we come to the real political differences within the political system, I think Egypt is far ahead with some substantive points that is suggesting for the rivals here in Cairo.
Hani Khalaf is the former Egyptian ambassador to Libya. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation funds billions of dollars in health and development projects around the world. As a result, it's become a major player in helping to shape global policies. In part two of her interview with Melinda Gates, VOA's Lenok Mudu spoke to Gates first about the growing use of contraceptives by women.
Well, for the first time in history, there are 300 million women in developing countries on contraceptives. We've never had that before. Now, there's a global goal to get 120 million women voluntary access to contraceptives by the year 2020. And so the right groundwork is being laid for that. That is, governments are looking at their supply chain issues and saying, okay, do we have all the tools that a woman might want, whether it's a long-acting tool or a short-acting contraceptive? Have we fixed the supply chain so that contraceptives are not just in the capital city, but out in the remote rural areas? Are we making sure we have the right policies so that, you know, the newer tools that have come along that are easier to use and have fewer side effects, women have access? And lastly, are we doing the cultural piece to educate men and women and even the religious leaders of why contraceptives actually make healthier families? I've seen countries take all of those steps. It's taking some time. Different countries are further ahead in different pieces of that, but I'm very encouraged by the groundwork that's being laid.
How do you think that men can be part of the solution when it comes to addressing the issue of contraceptives? Because as you mentioned, in some settings, men are very, very reluctant to see their women use it.
What we're seeing is that the men will buy into the idea of contraceptives when they understand that their children will be healthier. If you say to a man that your child will grow up healthier and have a better chance of being educated if your wife is able to space the birth by 3 years, we know that your child is 35% more likely to make it to their first birthday if the spacing has been by 3 years, and twice as likely to make it to their fifth birthday. Most dads that I have met all over the world are interested in having healthy children. Yeah. We also talk to them about the fact that their wife will be healthier.
So moving forward, what are some of the key issues that will be on top of the agenda for the foundation?
Well, you're going to see us continue to make investments and maybe more investments in nutrition, because that first 1,000-day window is so important that if a child doesn't grow up healthy, they don't have the chance to reach their full cognitive and developmental potential. Some more investments have to be made in that area, even quite honestly on the research agenda, because we're learning that different children's guts, depending on where they grow up and what their immune system is facing in those first few years of life, is very different in a country like Uganda versus Kenya versus South Africa. So we don't even understand as a world enough about a child's gut to understand exactly what intervention we should make. Should we give them more zinc? Should we give them more vitamin A, more vitamin D? So until that research agenda gets completed and filled out, or filling it out, will help us understand how to make the most key investments. You'll see us continuing on vaccines and really looking at this first 30 days of life of what else we can do to save so many children that die in those first 30 days.
Let's come back to women's health. Some people say that women have come a long way around the world economically and socially. One example is when we look at the MDGs, the literacy rate has improved globally, and the gap between women and men has narrowed among youth age 15 to 24. What do you make of this progress? How do you assess the status of women and girls, particularly in Africa?
Women and girls, we are absolutely making progress. I think we need to accelerate that progress. We need to intensify it, and we need to accelerate it. There is not yet parity for women in any country around the world, including my own. And until we reach parity on everything, we are not there yet. So I think continuing to make investments on behalf of women, making sure in particular in some African countries, despite the statistics getting better, they're absolutely better at the primary level, they're getting better at the secondary level, but there are still many places where a girl is pulled out of school early and she doesn't actually get to complete secondary school. And a quality education is incredibly important to everything we're discussing. If a girl or a boy doesn't have a quality education, they don't have the chance to go on to university if that's their dream. So we need to continue to make those investments on behalf of both boys and girls, and to do it equally.
That's Melinda Gates. She spoke with VOA's Leonard Moudou. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.